Thanks. So today I'm going to tell you something interesting in condensed matter physics, in particular from many-body entanglement. So the first part of this talk, I will briefly introduce the concept of phases of matter, phase transitions, and then tell you why many-body entanglement is interesting. And also the entanglement can help us to develop some numerical method to study many-body system. Okay, so as you know, the main focus of condensed matter research is to understand the phases of matter. The reason that this problem is interesting is because there are universal features underlying phases of matter. The first universal features was highlighted by Landau, that is symmetry. So if you go back to this water versus ice, you can realize that the water has a continuous translation symmetry. In contrast, the ice break this continuous translation symmetry to discrete translation symmetry. That's why those two phases are different from each other. The symmetry breaking can also happen in quantum world. That's how we can get phases like a superfluid and a superconductor. All those symmetry breaking phase can be nicely captured by an order parameter and also the phase transitions. You can think superfluid, you can use an order parameter, tell you whether the particles, the bosons are condensed or not. In the superfluid phase, this order parameter phi will condense, get a finite value, and in the multi-insulating phase, the order parameter is vanishing, which gives you a non-symmetry breaking phase, and then the transition between them just corresponds to this order parameter being gapless. So the whole system can be well described by this phi-4 theory. And that's how the idea of the symmetry plays in the quantum phases of matter. And you know that in quantum world, a very exotic property is this quantum entanglement. If you just have two qubit system, you can either write some product state, or you superpose this to product state, you can get an EPR pair. And that is one of the most weird properties in quantum mechanics, and such entanglement caused a lot of confusion at the early stage of the quantum mechanics. And also, you know that if you superpose all the bases together, you are not getting a more entangled state. Instead, you just get a trivial product state if you write in a proper basis. So this is quantum entanglement. If we look back to those symmetry breaking phase, what we can realize is that the symmetry, the entanglement of those symmetry breaking is actually quite trivial. For example, this ferromagnet is nothing but that I have all spins pointing along one direction. That's just a trivial product of those spins. And if we look at a superfluid, that looks like a bit of, more entangled. But if we look at it in a proper basis, that is a momentum space. This again goes back to a trivial product state that tells me all the bosons are condensed at certain momentum. So it's kind of boring that those phases are quantum mechanical phases, but the entanglement pattern is quite trivial. So what if we have some non-trivial interesting entanglement pattern and form it, what can we get? So the first example of such a non-trivial entanglement pattern happens in electronic system. So let's look to electrons. For electrons, a very simple state is called Fermi liquid. It's similar as superfluid. If you look at it in the momentum space, it's just a trivial product that you feel all the particles in your Fermi sea. In other words, you just feel all the particles whose momentum is smaller than your Fermi momentum. Okay, so if you expand such state in your real space, it gives you something looks entangled, but you know you can go back to momentum space and get a trivial product state. So now on top of it, we can get some interesting entanglement pattern. If you cross out several configurations, you can even put some complex phase factors in certain configurations. If you do it in a proper way, what you can get is called this Laughlin wave functions. This Laughlin wave functions indeed describes the first non-symmetry breaking phase that is called the fractional quantum Hall state observed in condensed matter physics. So It's a typical example of the so-called topological order. So I guess many of you have heard about the fractional quantum Hall state in condensed matter talk. Probably almost half of condensed matter talk will more or less mention this fractional quantum Hall state. So anyway, let me briefly remind you what it is. So in high school physics, we all learn about the classical Hall physics. That is, if suppose I have two-dimensional plane, I apply a magnetic field perpendicular to this plane, and then I introduce some current along one direction. And then due to the Lorentz force, I will have a voltage in the other direction. And in the classical world, this the resistance or the inverse of Hall conductance will be proportional to the strength of the magnetic field. However, in the quantum world, meaning that if you have a very low temperature as well as a high magnetic field, what you can observe is that this Hall conductance in some region of your magnetic field, this Hall conductance will be quantized. So generically it takes this form, and this nu is called the filling factor. This nu can be some integer number and even some fractional number. And if it is takes the fractional number, some of them can be described by this Laughlin wave function that I introduced before. So the interesting consequence of such, the interesting physics in such fractional quantum Hall state is that indeed I will have the emergent topological field theory, that is a Chern-Simons term specifically for this Laughlin function that will be level 3 Chern-Simons. And the consequence of such Chern-Simons term is that I will get fractionalized quasiparticles in such fractional quantum Hall state. So remember that our system is built up just using electrons. The electrons are carrying an integer charge. But due to this Chern-Simons, what you can have is that the electrons get fractionalized to some quasiparticles that carry in 1/3 charge. And those fractionalized quasiparticles will neither be boson nor fermions. Instead, it will be some anions. That is, if I wind one particles around the other, I can get some non-abelian phase factor. And you can even get non-abelian anions, and those non-abelian anions can be used to do the so-called topological quantum computation. So now you say that just for many-body entanglement, we can get something fundamentally interesting and also may have very good applications. So, and this observation of fractional quantum Hall state triggers lots of interest in condensed matter physics to understand the many-body entanglement. And also, many-body entanglement can lead to a lot of more exotic phenomenon. For example, a very recent proposal that is in some interacting fermionic system called Sachdev-Yerkitaev model, you might get the emergent quantum gravity. So although in this talk, I will not really say anything about this system, but I think it's worth mentioning that with many-body entanglement, which is purely quantum mechanics, you can get a lot of interesting things that is hard to imagine. So one reason that this many-body entanglement can give rise to those different physics is because the Hilbert space of a many-body system is generically very large. It grows exponentially with the degree of freedom, the qubits, that the particles that you have in the system. And also, this exponentially growing Hilbert space, on the other hand, poses some challenge for us to study. In particular, in a condensed matter system, we are interested in a very large number of particles, which will really give rise to a Hilbert space whose dimension is impossible to handle. So let me just briefly tell you how large this number is in terms of that if you want to store the wave function of a many-body system, how much memory it will cost. So typically, if you want to store like 30 qubits, what you need is like 10 gigabytes, that is the memory of a laptop. If you want to store some like 50 qubits, What you need is like a supercomputer, probably the most powerful supercomputer on the Earth. If you go to a slightly larger number, like 300 qubits, the memory cost will be a huge number that is almost similar as number of atoms in the observable universe. So this is really a huge Hilbert space, which is almost impossible to tackle either analytically or numerically. What comes to rescue us is some perspective from the quantum information side that is called the entanglement error law. So the basic idea is that although a Hilbert space of a generic many-body system is very large, but for many purposes, we are only interested in a very a specific portion of this Hilbert space, and those states will those states are the ground state of a local Hamiltonian. And for such system, there will be some constraints like on things like entanglement. So we can consider a system and we divide it to A and B part. We can ask how much entanglement do I get between A and B? So one way to quantify this entanglement is called the entanglement entropy. What you can do is that you integrate out this A part, you get a reduced density matrix, and using this reduced density matrix, you can define this entanglement entropy. So for a generic system, for a generic state, the entanglement entropy will follow this so-called volume law. That is easy to imagine because you can think that every single qubits or particles in this B region will entangle with A region. So that's why you can get a volume law. However, a quantum information study told us that if you consider a local gapped Hamiltonian, its ground state and also several excitations above this ground state will satisfy the so-called area law. So that is the entanglement entropy between A and B will scale with the area of the boundary between A and B. So, and even for a gapless system, you might get a log L correction, but it's still not the volume law. And I also want to mention that for some critical system, for some gapless system, like conformal field theory in 2 plus 1D, it actually follows this area law instead of the volume law. So now you see that many interesting physics actually don't have this very large entanglement. Instead, it has this area law. And for such states, we can design a very good, we have a very efficient way to write its wave functions and to do some numerical experiment. Let me take an example called this matrix product state. So it describes the system in a one dimension. By one dimension, I mean one spatial dimension. So let's consider a 1D system. If I want to write a generic wave function, it's just that I superpose every basis and put a weight for each basis. So generically, I will get like the complex number like d to the power n. So that's a very huge number. But if the state follows the entanglement error law for 1D system, that just means that entanglement between A and B is a constant, which doesn't depend on the length of this A or B part. Okay, if such state follows this error law, what we can do is that we can write the so-called matrix product state to efficiently, to almost exactly describe this very complex, complicated wave functions. So the way that is just for each side, you define a tensors. And this tensor has a physical index, tells me that which state I'm in, like spin up or spin down, and we get some virtual index, which tells me how this site is entangled between its neighboring sites. Okay, so now we just get several tensors, which has very small complex numbers. And then for each coefficient, what you need to do is just you multiply those tensors or matrices together, you will get this number. Okay, and this method is
actually the essence of the so-called density matrix randomization invented by Steve White. And so with this type of wave function ansatz, we can do very straightforward numerical experiment to study many-body system. And in the later part of this talk, I will show some results to using this method to study many-body system.
So what is chi?
Chi is the dimension of this virtual index.
Yes, and what is it physically?
Physically just means how much entanglement do you have between this. Yeah. So it's like the entanglement of MPS will be like some number proportional to log chi. Yeah. So, yeah. So for any system, what you can do is that if you increase the chi, the more accuracy you will get in the numerical experiment. Yeah. Okay. So this matrix product state can be generalized to higher dimensions that is generically referred as tensor network state, and like the so-called PAPS and also MERA, which was invented by Giffrey Widell. And also this MERA that is really, it can describe even critical system very nicely. Okay, this is the tensor network. Okay, now let me go to the second part, that is I will specifically focus on the so-called the spin-liquid phase, which is a very special many-body entangled state. And I will first introduce what is spin-liquid and then go to some specific examples like how the spin-liquid physics emerges and how we understand it. Okay, so now what we want to play is that we just have some simple spins and we put it on some lattice. On each lattice site, and I put some interactions, some Hamiltonians tells me how the spin are interacting with each other. So the hope is that by put some interactions, the ground state of the system will have some interesting many-body entanglement, which gives rise to some emergent phenomenon. Okay, so now, for this spin system, a very natural state is called the magnetic order state. It's nothing but that I have spins on each side pointing to some directions. For example, here, if I take antiferromagnetic interactions, the spins will antiparallel between each other, and this breaks the spin rotation symmetry. So for many systems, this is actually the ground state. It's a quite boring classical state. So to get some quantum mechanics, what we can do is that we just let them to form some singlet pairs. But by doing this, you can realize that I still have some product state. It's nothing but the product of singlet pairs. So, but it's already very close to a many-body entangled state. What you can do is that you allow those singlet pairs to resonate, which was originally proposed by Anderson, and it's in generally it's some sort of spin-liquid phase. The idea is that we begin with some singlet coverings, and now we allow some of those coverings to resonate to the other type of singlet pairings. I superpose them together, and I keep on doing this. I let other terms to resonate and on, I get an extensive large number of such singlet coverings. I superpose them together in some fashion. So by doing this, we can get some entanglement, some non-trivial entanglement pattern between those many spins. So, but here is just some pictures. It's important to understand two things. The first thing is that what is the property of such state? The second is where can we find such state? Okay, so this state does not break any symmetry. So, and it has some interesting phenomenon called the fractionalization and emergent gauge field. So remember that what we begin with like spin one half system. So any elementary excitations in such system is actually spin one. The way to think about it is that the excitation, if you want to create an excitation, you need to flip a spin. That like you flip the spin from spin up to spin down, and that creates a spin one excitation. So in spin liquid, what's interesting is that
this spin 1 excitations can get fractionalized to spin 1 half excitations, and you get some emergent gauge field interacting with them. It's not the end of the story, because you can get many different types of this emergent gauge field, and also those fractionalized particles, it calls spin-on, it carries spin 1 half. The spin-ons can have different type of properties. And this gives you many different types of spin liquid. For example, those gauge field can have some topological, can be described by some topological field theory. It can also be described by some discrete gauge theory. And those spin-ons can be some Dirac fermions, and they can couple to some U1 gauge field. So all those things will correspond to different type of spin liquid phase. Okay, so this is the general idea of the spin liquid. The next question we will turn to is like, where can we find it? There is a very nice example of a spin liquid that is toric-cold proposed by Kitaev. So you may have heard about this. If you are not familiar with it, don't bother with the details. It's not very important for the purpose of this talk. So this model is defined on a square lattice. You put some spins on the link of this square lattice, and those spins are interacting through some four-body terms, which generically looks like this. So a nice thing of this model is you can exactly solve it, and also you can map it to some discrete Z2 gauge theory. That's how you get that's how you say this emergent gauge theory in terms of originally you just have some spins. And also in such a toric-cold model, you get some fractionalized quasi-particles like E particles and M particles. They have some mutual fractional statistics. It's a very nice model, but what we hope to do is that we hope to get spin liquid physics in terms of simple interactions. Here we have four body interactions. It's very difficult to realize in nature, and also we hope to get some other interesting physics other than the discrete Z2 gauge theory. So we want to turn to just a system described by simple Heisenberg interactions. And you know that if we just consider such system on a square lattice, I will end up with a boring magnetic order state. So we want to suppress this magnetic ordering. That's one way to suppress it is we turn to the so-called frustration. This is a classical figure of this frustration. You just think about three spins. For the moment, we just think about classical spin. Okay, and we put it with some antiferromagnetic interactions, and we put on these triangles. And now if we look at one bond, to minimize the energy, I need those two spins to antiparallel to each other. But now there will be some confusion to the third spin, because no matter which direction it points to, it will always frustrated one bond, which gives me a maximal energy. So now what we can do is that we bring a lot of these triangles together, which might eventually suppress a magnetic order. The first idea is that we just consider this triangle lattice. Indeed, that's where Anderson first proposed the idea of the spin liquid. But eventually it turns out that if I only have first neighbor Heisenberg interactions on this triangle lattice, its ground state is indeed a magnetic order state. The trick here is that each spin can compromise each other a little bit, that each two neighbor spins are not antiparallel to each other perfectly. Instead, they have 120 degrees. And by doing this, you can still minimize the energy. And it turns out that this way of ordering is the ground state of this triangular Heisenberg model. So we need to go to a little more complicated system that is called the Kagome lattice. This Kagome lattice is again formed by these triangles, but here it's a corner sharing triangles. To get a triangular lattice, what you can do is that on each hexagon, you put a side in the center of those hexagons. You will recover this triangular lattice. So this is a Kagome lattice.
Now comes a very simple question. That is, what if I put first neighbor Heisenberg interactions on this Kagome lattice? What is its ground state? People begin to ask this question more than 20 years ago, but it turns out that it is a very difficult question to solve. And here I only give a very partial list that was trying to address this problem, and every possible candidate has been proposed for this single model. However, until now, it's still hotly debated on what is its ground state. Yeah. A very important work is done by Hughes and White. They use a large-scale DMRG simulations and show that its ground state is very likely to be a spin liquid phase. But as I introduced before, we can have many different types of spin liquid phase. It's still unclear which spin liquid it is.
Is it because it has a unique ground state?
That's a good question. So
because classically it does.
Yeah. So I think quantum mechanically it has unique ground state, but I don't know how to prove it. It's all, you know, you can only do numerics on this. So yeah, numerically it's hard to tell what happens in the thermodynamic limit. Okay, so I will call it Kagome spin liquid, and later I will provide you some evidence that this Kagome spin liquid is very likely to be the Dirac spin liquid phase. Okay, and you might think that this Kagome lattice looks quite complicated, quite artificial. But actually there are several materials like this called Herbert-Smithite can realize this model plus some other terms. But in this talk, I will not talk anything related with this experiments. Instead, I will just try to understand the system theoretically. Yeah. Okay. So now, that's first.
Those ones that realize it in nature, are they in layers? Are they essentially 2D? Because this is what you showed us is two dimensions.
Yeah. That's a good question. So they are layers. Yeah. The coupling between layers is quite weak. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So let's first learn some spin liquid candidate for this Kagome spin liquid. The first example that I will introduce is called the Z2 spin liquid phase. It is a gapped spin liquid phase. One way to get such a Z2 spin liquid is that, again, we consider this resonant valence bound state. And I just superpose different singlet coverings. And here, what I need to constrain is that the singlet pairs are always formed by spins which are very close to each other. For example, we can ask that only spins are neighboring each other to form the singlets. And then I superpose them equivalently. What I will get is this so-called Z2 spin liquid phase. And people have shown that for such a spin liquid phase, it has the exactly same topological order as this toric code that I introduced before. So in such Z2 spin liquid, you get spin-ons, it carries spin 1/2, and also you get visons, which is the gauge flux of the Z2 gauge field, and the spin-ons and visons has a mutual semionic statistics. So this is the so-called Z2 spin liquid phase. There's also another type of gapped spin liquid called the chiral spin liquid phase. Similar as the Z2 spin liquid, you can use short-range RVB to construct it. And this chiral spin liquid breaks time reversal symmetry. So what the extra thing you need to do is that you put some phase factors in front of several certain configurations. So if you do it in a proper way, that you can get this chiral spin liquid. It is actually same as this 1/2 Laughlin state for fractional quantum Hall state of bosons. And the physics there is that you get emergent Chern-Simons term, and due to this, the spin-ons will have the semionic statistics. That is, if you exchange two spin-ons, you will get half pi phase factor. Okay, so this is also a gapped spin-liquid phase. You can we can get some gapless spin-liquid phase if you allow that the singlet pairs can happen between spins which are far from each other. And that actually you can have lots of different types of gapless spin-liquid. The trick is that you can put certain different weight for those single configurations, although the details might be very complicated and very difficult to figure out. But anyway, so you can get a different type of gapless spin liquids, and one interesting type is called the Dirac spin liquid phase. Such Dirac spin liquid phase are described by the Dirac fermions, which are spin-ons, and they are coupled to some emergent U1 gauge field. So the effective theory is just this QED3 theory. And it's quite a magic because originally we begin with pure bosonic system that are just some localized spin 1/2 object, but eventually I get emergent Dirac fermions and coupled to a gauge field. Okay.
So explain when that happens? So what are the conditions for that?
That's quite difficult actually. Okay. Here is just some pictures
so
that
it's
build some intuition like.
So here it's because okay.
Yeah.
Here it's where it's a model which has that.
Right. Yeah. So there are two questions. The first question is that suppose I just write such wave functions, and how do I put those wave functions such that I can get those Dirac spin liquid phase? Actually, even for that question is, at least I don't know how to do it, frankly. And also for the chiral spin liquid, we don't know how to put those weight. What I think for this moment, what we do know is that for Z2 spin liquid, you just have nearest neighbor single pairs and you put them to have equal amplitude, you can get Z2 spin liquid. Yeah. But there are some other ways to construct this spin liquid phase. Yeah, here I just try to provide some intuitive picture, like how to think about those spin liquid phase.
So should think about the third one as the second order phase transition between the first and the second?
I will go to the phase transition later. Yeah, there will be some. You mean the phase transition between different
spin? The third one, the gapless.
Right. Yeah. So.
Typically, we have a
Galois
formation, right?
From Dirac spin liquid, you can have a transition to Z2 spin liquid or chiral spin liquid. The Z2 spin liquid, you can just imagine that the Dirac fermions are from some BCS pairing, such that the U1 gauge field is broken down to a Z2 gauge field, that you get a Z2 spin liquid. For the chiral spin liquid, what you can think is that you put some mass term for those Dirac fermions, and then the system is a gapped break time reversal, and if you integrate out those mass terms, you will get the Chern Simons. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I had a similar question to Laurent, which is you showed all these different possibilities.
Yeah.
Do we know, at least in principle, that for each one of them there's some Hamiltonian that will give that?
Yeah, I will come this to in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So now, yeah, the question is where really to find them. So if we write some Hamiltonians, whether we can get to the ground state of those spin liquid ground state. So let's go back to this Kagome lattice. And here we consider some models that have like first neighbor interactions between Heisenberg interactions between those spins, and also we put second and third neighbor interactions. So remember that if I only have first neighbor interactions, this model goes back to the long-standing Kagome-Heisenberg problem that people were trying to figure out for decades. And in our study, this spin liquid looks like this Dirac spin liquid phase that is described by Dirac fermions coupled with a gauge field. And if I put some second, third neighbor interactions, this Dirac spin liquid gets changed to this chiral spin liquid. Yep.
Just a bit, I'm confused by your axis, right? It's G prime over G1. You
yep.
mean the other way around.
No.
Well, when it's zero, it means G1 is infinite, no?
Oh,
you mean, okay, so
G prime is zero. Yeah.
G prime, sorry.
Yep.
G
Should I interpret the diagram saying that you land on a CFT without any fine tuning?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But the CFT, does it have relevant operators?
Sorry?
Does the CFT have relevant operators? Does the CFT have relevant operators?
Relevant.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So if you keep all the symmetry, there's no relevant operator.
So what are the symmetries here?
Some lattice symmetry and also time reversal symmetry. That's correspond. All those symmetries will forbid the mass term of the Dirac fermions. Okay. So yeah, this is the phase diagram we get. Now let's turn to some numerical evidence that how we identify those phases. Okay. So let's first go to something easier, that is the chiral spin liquid phase, because the reason that it's easier because it is gapped and also have this transcendence term emerged, so it means it has topological order. Numerically, it's quite straightforward to deal with such system. One numerical evidence that we can get is that due to the transcendence, so remember that this chiral spin liquid is indeed the fractional quantum Hall state of bosons. So it has this Hall conductance. And there are several neat ways to measure this Hall conductance numerically. So that is, if we insert some flux in the system, I will observe some charge pumping, that's spin pumping. So then this is the numerical results that you say that if I vary the flux, I really see some charges pumps from left side to the right side. It's quantized, it's almost linear, and it's from a numerical experiment. So this gives us one evidence that this chiral spin liquid emerges. And the other thing is that we can indeed measure the so-called fractional statistics from the module metrics, thanks to many interesting technical developments, particularly Giffrey's work that tells us how to do it using DMRG. So we generically can get some metrics that tells us what's the fractional statistics of it. Don't bother with those details. So yeah, so from this, we can get the fractional statistics of this. So of those spin-ons, it tells us that we really have this emergent transcendence term. Okay. So now let's turn to this Dirac spin liquid. It becomes more tricky to identify this Dirac spin liquid. And there, so one evidence that we can try is that we can try to observe this Dirac cones from the excitation spectrum. So it turns out that in the DMRG method, there is a very nice way to get some information about the excitation spectrum, which was pointed out by this paper. So it's quite technical. So I don't want to bother you with the details. Yeah.
But if it's a conformal field theory, it will not have free particles or particles in every street, right?
That's true. Yeah. But if you just ask, well, you still get excitations. It's.
But I'm not gonna be seeking a Dirac cone, right? It's even clear that there are particles.
So strictly speaking, it's not really particles, but an intuitive way to think about it, you still get some particles, right? But it's interacting with a gauge field, so eventually it's like, how to put it, it will get a gist of a lot of things, which eventually turns it to some non-quasi-particle picture. But if you just ask, what do you get in a CFT? That you get like state operator correspondence, things like that, and just think about it as some operators that gives you such excited state.
So when you study a gap phase in two dimensions, you can use the energy in a cylinder.
Right.
Assuming that the width of the cylinder is large enough compared to the mass gap, right?
Yeah.
So you are essentially the thermodynamic limit there. But in a couplet, in a CFT, in a 2 plus 1 CFT, when you put it on a lattice or on a cylinder, you expect that to deform the theory in an important way.
The there are two things. The first thing is that even you get a critical system, you can still mimic it with a DMRG with a very large bound dimension. You know, it works at least for 1D system.
You're saying that if the 2 plus 1 CFD has a 1
dimensional
descendant.
Yeah, descendant. Okay, yeah, so yeah, that's something like that. Yeah. So
what's 2 plus 1 descendant?
Just like, imagine if you have three Dirac fermions in 2 plus 1D, you put it in a cylinder geometry, it still behaves like 1 dimension, 1 plus 1D Dirac fermions.
Yes.
That's the 1 plus 1D descendant we're talking about.
Do you know what the descendant is of QED?
It's for QED. There are some idea. So a descendant will be generically like some Luttinger liquid. So recently there was some proposal like from this couple, by coupling Luttinger liquid, you can get QED3. It's so called the couple wire construction. I'm not entirely sure like how to make a very exact correspondence. I want to say that it's still an open issue, like what this. So it looks like very like Dirac spin liquid, but we don't know the precise properties of this Dirac spin liquid. This, you know, even for QD3, you don't know the precise properties if you have a small flavor of Dirac fermions.
So think about these pictures as sort of trying to see that there is a scaling variance spectrum.
Yeah, right. That's true, yeah. Okay, so this is the some excitation spectrum, and that we say that there is a very sharp Dirac cones that is the red mode, and well, and the position of this Dirac cones, its momentum matches exactly what you expect for this Dirac spin liquid, and here I compare it with some free fermions that also, that corresponds to the Parton answers of this Dirac spin liquid. You say that those two systems agrees quite well. Okay, that's one numerical evidence. And also, we can try to do something else, like to use the entanglement entropy to say whether there is a Dirac QD3 or Dirac fermions. So you might be familiar that if you have 1 plus 1 DCFT, the entanglement entropy can serve a very nice probe for this CFT. That is, if you consider, if you cut the system into A and B part and ask what's the entanglement entropy between A and B, you can get a very universal scaling functions. This L is just the total system size. This LB is just the system size of this B part. And this C is just a central charge. So, and here you can say that the numerically, this scaling function works perfectly. So that's 1 plus 1D. So now what we want to do is that we want to go to 2 plus 1D. That since becomes much more complicated. And for 2 plus 1D, there are also studies to use the entanglement entropy to learn something about those CFTs. In particular, Roger Melko has done a lot of things. So here, we consider a setup that proposed in those two papers. That is, we put this 2 plus 1D CFT on a cylinder. By cylinder, I mean you put the spatial dimensions on a cylinder. And then you cut it into two pieces, that A and B part. And then you get some entanglement entropy. The next thing you can do is that you insert some flux through this cylinder. So then the entanglement entropy will change. To have some idea about how the entanglement will behave, let's just look at free Dirac fermions. If I put it on a cylinder, I will get several quantized modes whose momentum is quantized along this short direction. And then by change this flux, those quantized modes will move. So those quantized momentum are just something like the mass. If you think it as some several 1D Dirac fermions, 1 plus 1D Dirac fermions, their momentum along this short direction are just the mass term of this Dirac fermions. And then this mass term will depend on the this flux inserted. So then what you can do is that for free fermions, you can work out the entanglement entropy. It will just scale with this universal scaling functions. So of course, we don't know what happens for QD3. But for QD3 with large flavor of Dirac fermions, you can use large range expansions and figure out that its entanglement entropy still behaves like this, but the prefactor will times some number related with the flavor of Dirac fermions. We don't know what happens for a small flavor of Dirac fermions, but what about we just use our numerical data and say whether that's match. Now, here is the numerical data that you show that you say that, well, the entanglement entropy matches quite well with this scaling function, although we don't know the physical meaning of this prefactor, but it's already quite nice that the scaling function from free Dirac fermions works also nicely for the QD3 theory. Yeah.
Is this diverging when theta is zero?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
here we.
That means no flux.
No flux. You get one zero mode, and
oh,
if you.
Zero mode.
Only one zero mode, only one momentum across this Dirac point, and then there's something like 1D Lattice liquid, then you get divergent entanglement entropy. So here
this is the divergence coming from the zero mode.
From zero mode, yeah, exactly. So it corresponds to here, which we cannot achieve, but before that, you say this curve really fits quite nicely. It's only a numerical experiment; we don't know. Yeah.
Have there similar measurements for other CFDs, like your true model?
Probably Roger can answer that. I don't know.
In a way, there is some tests.
Numerically, is the true model, for example, with the
is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's kind of the universal functions that we test for ON models and Eisen models. And critical models.
Okay.
What does L sub C mean? Length of the.
That's the length of this short direction. You get an error law part. Yeah, you get an error law part, or probably some other subleading term which doesn't depend on this theta. Okay. So now I hope that I provide. Quite convincing numerical evidence that I get two spin liquid phase. One is this Dirac spin liquid phase, which is a CFT, and also the other chiral spin liquid phase that is described by some topological field theory. Okay, now it's interesting to ask what would the phase transition between them look like, and how would it describe the whole system? So the field theory is just a Gross-Nauru QD3, that I get a QD3 part, and meanwhile I have a Z2 rail scatter that couples Dirac fermions through a Yukawa coupling. So now you can say that if this phi field is gapped, I will get a Dirac spin liquid phase. If phi field is condensed, I will get a mass term for those Dirac fermions, and if I integrate out them, I get a transimus term. So this describes the chiral spin liquid, and the transition between them just corresponds to this phi field being gapless, which is another CFT. So,
Sorry, is this a proposal?
It's a proposal, yeah.
Is that your proposal?
Well.
What I mean is, this comes from your numerical observations and then?
My numerical observations suggest that their transition is continuous. And also we know there's spontaneous time reversal symmetry breaking there, so that's a very natural field theory that you can write.
So the yellow point should be that it's more complicated CFD.
Right. Yeah.
So when you say QED, how many fermions do you have? Just a very minimal amount? How many fermions do you have?
Four flavors. Two components Dirac fermions. If you count it as two components, you get four flavors.
suitable about symmetry for this theory is SO4.
SU4. Okay, yeah. So this, so yeah, one reason that we kind of believe this is the right scenario because we are very confident of this chiral spin liquid, and then very natural theory is just that we get Dirac here and their transitions.
So how much of this SU4 is present on the lattice?
Well, that's very difficult to test because the lattice size is quite small, so then it's far from the scale.
I don't understand why that there are no relevant operators. Just time reverse symmetry enough to prevent all.
Oh, no. You need some other discrete symmetries.
Okay.
Yeah. If you, so that corresponds to you put different type of mass term for those Dirac fermions.
Right.
Yeah. And that will break some lattice symmetry, and give rise to some order state that can be used as a test.
Can you measure the? You even use if you just deform a little bit. If you break the symmetry just a little bit, can you measure the normal dimensions of those?
That's very difficult because essentially what we are dealing is like quasi 1D system. So then the scaling dimension we say is somehow more close to 1D critical system. Because we put it on a cylinder, and then the circumference of the cylinder is quite small. So then, you know, it's just a far from the scaling limit. Yeah, it will be very interesting to think about it. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So now I hope that I have convinced you that by many entangled spins, we can get quite interesting physics, like topological field theory, like some electrodynamics, and also Dirac fermions, and also some other CFTs. It's also interesting to know how do we understand it theoretically. I don't have time to really go to everything, but probably the most interesting thing is that we get emergent Dirac fermions. So let me just give you a quick idea that how to think about emergent Dirac fermions in terms of bosonic system. So the basic setup is like two species of bosons. It seems to be very different from the spin liquid phase that I described, but there are some relations with the spin liquid in a very precise fashion. But yeah, that's just for a moment, we just consider two species of bosons that we have A and B. And one thing that by designing some interactions, you can get those bosons forming the so-called bosonic integer quantum Hall state. And phenomenologically, that means that if you have a current of A along one direction, it will generate a voltage along the other directions. And in terms of theory, that you can describe it by a mutual transimons. This AA and AB are just the probing field of A and B bosons. So that is the bosonic integer quantum Hall state. Now, what we can do is that we consider its transition to a trivial state that doesn't have any Hall response and ask what happens in between them at the critical point. So naively, what we can say is that, well, what about its Hall conductance is just average of both sides like this. And if this happens, we can figure out that you do get Dirac fermions in the system. The way to think about it at near this critical point, the way to think about it is that now let's just consider a 2-pi vortex of A bosons. And due to this mutual transimons, what I will get is that on the core of this 2-pi vortex, I will trap half charge of B, that is a polarization charge. That's nothing but the transimons gives me. Okay. And now I do something similar that I consider 2-pi vortex of B. On its core, it will trap like half a charge of A. And now what we can figure out is that those two objects actually have some mutual semiotic statistics. That's nothing but Abelhoff Bohm phase because it's a composite of the charge and flux. So now if you bind them together, you will get a fermions, and which can be a Dirac fermions. That's intuitive way to think about how you get Dirac fermions out of a pure bosonic system, and it's indeed related with the spin liquid phase I discussed before. You might be skeptical on this because why I'm allowed to bind those two composite objects together, why I just don't let them move freely, don't really talk to each other too much. If I do that, I get actually some so-called CP1 theory. That's the some complex bosons coupled with emergent gauge field. And indeed, you can do that, and those two theories are suggested to due to each other. It's just different ways to write the same theory. Well, on the one side, you get Dirac fermions. That's two-flavored Dirac fermions. And on the other side, you get the CP1 theory. They are due to each other by those interesting papers. Okay, so you say that really in condensed matter physics, that this many-body entanglement gives us a lot of interesting physics, even also less dualities. You say that some very famous people in the high energy physics are also thinking about such dualities in the gauge theory. Okay, and also from this duality, we can also get some interesting thing like the composite from a liquid. Okay, so let me wrap up. So I hope that I have convinced you that the many-body entanglement can lead to many exotic phenomena, and spin liquid is a very simple setup that can give us those interesting physics. And at last, let me thank for your time and also thank for my collaborators.
This is just a historical comment, but you gave this example of getting fermions from bosons by having flux, electric charge and magnetic flux together. This was actually, what you discussed was two dimensions,
right,
two plus
right.
one dimension.
Yeah.
It actually, the original suggestion of that type is almost a century old, and it goes back, and it's in three plus one dimensions. It's Asen Saha, I think Asen is right initials, called Saha Dyons, which are combinations of electric charges, again, the same thing, dyons, and that meaning something which carries both an electric and a magnetic charge together. This was an unbound magnetic charge. And he argued quantum mechanically that when you work out the angular momentum, because of the E cross B currents in the field, you could, by the quantization of angular momentum, you could get spin a half. And when you did, you would get fermionic statistics. And that's now well established. Now, I mean, that's a historical comment. But it goes with a question, which is, in some sense, in two dimensions, one can argue there's not a real distinction between bosons and fermions, 2+1, in the way that there is in 3+1. So it would be even more interesting if you had examples in 3+1 of this kind of emergent fermionic statistics. Do you know of any such example? I mean, we have models in quantum gravity and stuff, but in condensed matter.
Yeah, there was some example like a decade ago by Xiaogang Wen and Michael Levin. They study something similar as Kitaev's toric code. They put it on a three-dimensional system and say it is exact solvable, and they can show that the excitations are fermionic.
It's not with flux tubes or anything, not with strings.
yes,
string. No, but I mean point-like objects.
They are point-like objects.
They are point-like objects.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess in Dirac spin liquid, spin SU2 symmetry is part of larger SU4.
Yes. Yeah.
So in the chiral spin liquid, I'm not sure whether SU2 symmetry, how is it manifest in the
You can think about Dirac fermions, and to get chiral spin liquid you put the same mass for every Dirac fermions. So you still get this SU2 symmetry. It's all the mass of Dirac fermions.
How does this Chern-Simons
Chen Simons only tells about the gauge field. They are singlets. Yeah.
But I thought that is related to flux for S-step conserved.
Right. That's the Chen Simons somehow related with the so-called scalar chirality of three spins. So yeah, it's something like flux. So you just consider three spins on a triangle, on a triangles, then Chen Simons would be something like this, just roughly. No.
One last question.
You might have covered this in the introduction, which I part of which I missed. But is there a short and simple definition of what does a spin, what is meant by spin leakage?
So many people have many different definitions. So my definition is that it has emergent fractionalized particles like spinons and gauge field. That's my definition.
So it means if anything with an emergent gauge field and emergent fractionalized
particles
should be called
spin liquid. Yeah, I will call it spin liquid.
Good. So are there examples of 3D, 3 plus 1D?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that's called, one example is called quantum spin ice. And in that, you can map it to just like U1 gauge theory in 3 plus 1D. Yeah. And for that model, you can even figure out how, work out analytically to say how those gauge field emerges.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And it has also fractionalized charge.
Yeah, right.
So if it just had gauge field but not fractionalized charges, you wouldn't call it a spin liquid.
But how can you
and, have? Or is that, are there such things?
But if you have gauge field, you somehow you should have matter, no matter is gapped or not. Mm-hmm. So then those matter should be fractionalized, right? Because it carries gauge charge.
But it could be a unit charge.
Unit charge is also gauge charge, I mean. Originally, you don't begin with system without gauge symmetry, right?
Yes.
So then any gauge carrying quasi-particles should, in some sense, considered as a fractional charge.
Fraction of what, though?
Usually, it will be fractionalized of some global symmetry.
I see.
Yeah.
So basically, you think the two go together?
Yeah. Right.
Okay. There are no more questions. Let's thank Inch.